And now from the culture of tech innovation to the way new tech is received in the culture. Google is trying to sell the world on its wearable computer, Google Glass. Like a pair of glasses, it sits on the nose with a tiny computer built into the lens. It is still in the beta stages. The company has given out a limited number so far. And outside of high tech, the eyewear is raising eyebrows. Lawmakers in several states want to ban it on the roads. Here's Aarti Shahani from member station KQED.
Before we turn to the laws, let's hit the road. Shane Walker hops into his Prius hybrid and puts on his Google Glass.
I'm just going to have us go home really quickly, so I'm going to go check on my dog.
Walker is an independent developer who got Glass last year to play with it and build apps. He turns on the GPS, and it doesn't start talking to him like maps on a smartphone might. Instead, it shows him his route as a thin blue line and a triangle on the upper right-hand corner of his lens.
Google did a good job of making it non-intrusive, so it's not directly in your line of sight.
Walker's favorite feature is the camera. Say you're on a road trip. You can record the entire thing in totally decent resolution, and then
you could go and, you know, one click, you could share it out to your friends.
At a stop sign, Walker strokes his frame with his right index finger. He's flipping through stored photos. The movement is so discreet, no bending his neck down like you would with a smartphone. I have to ask him.
Okay, is it something you would do if there was a police officer right in front of you?
I mean, it's debatable. So it is hands-free. So I do feel like in my legal right that it's okay for me to interact with stuff that doesn't require my hands, like winking, taking pictures.
Yeah, it's hands-free, but it can affect your vision.
Illinois State Senator Ira Silverstein is a Democrat from Chicago, and he's written a bill that says using glass equals distracted driving.
The first offense would be a misdemeanor. Second offense, if it causes death, could be a felony.
Leading car insurance companies have not yet taken a position on glass, but at least eight states have. Republican State Delegate Gary Howell of West Virginia says lawmakers need to act before glass gets out of hand.
You could be wearing it, driving down the road, not looking at your driving, but watching a video screen, reading text, and watching cat videos.
Glass is the ultimate multitasking machine. It streams incoming emails and scans the eyelid for blinking commands. But Delegate Howell says its high-tech creators aren't seeing a basic fact about the real world.
Have they driven on mountain roads in West Virginia where, you know, you've got one 15-mile-an-hour turn after another one where you really need to be concentrating on what you're doing?
Google is responding to this roadblock by sending lobbyists across the country to dispel concerns. Spokesman Chris Dale says glass can help drivers.
It's actually not distracting, and it allows you, rather than looking down at your phone, you're looking up and you're engaging with the world around you. And it was specifically designed to do that, to get you the technology you need just when you need it, but then to get out of your way.
Back in Shane Walker's car, glass does something that a smartphone can't do. We turn a corner past a golden fire hydrant, and suddenly, obscure facts start streaming in front of Walker's iris.
When San Francisco burst into flames in the days following the disastrous 1906 earthquake, much of the city's network of fire hydrants failed. Miraculously, this fire hydrant, nicknamed the
and
Little
And he Giant, goes on reading like this for about a half a minute.
...the historic Mission District neighborhood.
Are you reading all of that from the upper right-hand corner of your eye?
Exactly, yeah. It's pretty cool. It's like text just floating in air.
Walker has a theory about why this text is not distracting him.
The layer is transparent, so your eye does a good job of seeing through it while also staring at it.
That sounds like a lot of wishful thinking to me.
Earl Miller is a professor of neuroscience at MIT who specializes in multitasking.
You think you're monitoring the road at the same time, when actually what you're doing, you're relying on your brain's prediction that nothing was there before half a second ago, so nothing is going to be there now. But that's an illusion that can often lead to disastrous results.
The brain fills the gaps in what you see with memories of what you saw half a second ago. Among scientists, that statement is not controversial. The politics of Google Glass and where it's worn clearly is. For NPR News, I'm Aarti Shahani in San Francisco.
Okay, here's a question. If a tree falls in the forest and someone records it, does the sound last forever? We are increasingly finding out that the answer is no. Fragile records from the 1940s are breaking. Cassette tapes from the 80s are falling apart. Not even digital is forever. NPR's Emily Siner explores how the Library of Congress is trying to save millions of our nation's recordings before they're lost.
When an archaeologist discovers fragments of a civilization, the result is pretty incredible. Just listen to Andrea Berlin. She's an archaeologist and professor at Boston University, and her very first dig was in southern Israel.
I found myself excavating the room of a house that somebody had lived in around 800 BCE.
Oh my gosh.
That's what I thought. I felt like a time traveler.
Berlin studies people in the Mediterranean from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. She finds their sculptures and tools and lots of pottery. But one thing she doesn't find is their audio.
I think archaeologists are jealous of historians who have modern information sources, audio, for example, individual interviews and shows and recordings.
Because sound adds another layer of context to history. Jean Deanna at the Library of Congress has an example.
Hearing Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed.
To hear him say it rather than read the words is a much more visceral and significant, I think, medium for it.
Deanna oversees the library's decades-long project to digitize the sounds of the past, from iconic speeches.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
To patriotic songs from World War I.
Make your mother proud of you and the old red, white, and blue.
To operatic tenor Enrico Caruso singing in 1904. But preserving audio is a bigger job than it sounds. When working with old formats, it's a race against time. With wax cylinders from the 1890s, the heat from your hands can cause them to crack. Records made of glass during World War II are so fragile that they can break even when they're handled properly. And Deanna says if it's on a cassette tape, it's automatically at risk.
No matter how well it was recorded, by whom, on what equipment, it's on a cassette, and it's just a terrible format for archiving.
So this is a big job. They're digitizing about 15,000 recordings a year, and that's only a fraction of what they have.
We're probably acquiring between 50 and 100,000 a year. We're at least stabilizing them in a good environment so that their deterioration will slow down and we'll hopefully get to most of them before they're lost.
The good news is they're not the only ones working on it. Other institutions like the Harvard Library and Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory are also making strides in preserving audio. The trick is preserving not only the audio from the past, but also the audio we're recording today. Andrea Berlin says if that survives, future archaeologists will be thrilled.
I'm always thinking, well, in 200 years and in 500 years and in 1,000 years, there will be other people studying us. Maybe they'll be able to hear us.
Emily Siner, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon's research arm has been involved in the development of new technology from the birth of the internet to self-driving cars to the design and deployment of robots. But some researchers worry about the Pentagon's priorities. They're concerned it may be heading toward the creation of autonomous robots designed to kill. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
These days, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA, is probably best known for its robotics contests.
And good morning, everyone, and welcome to the 2013 DARPA Robotics Challenge.
10 years ago, a similar contest helped spur the creation of self-driving cars. DARPA's latest robotics challenge was inspired by the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Fear of radiation poisoning kept utility workers at the Fukushima plant from shutting off and effectively cooling reactors faster. Ultimately, three of the plant's six reactors melted down.
And there's good evidence that if we had been able to send in some kind of robot and had that robot do relatively simple things, simple manual tasks like opening valves, opening doors, getting to control panels, that a lot of the follow-on disaster could have been averted.
So Brian Gerke at the Open Source Robotics Foundation says DARPA's challenge, its latest challenge, is to build that robot, one that can open doors, move debris, turn a valve, even climb into and drive a conventional car.
And of course, getting out of the driver's seat possess significant strength and dexterity. That really is a challenge for the robots.
This past December, 16 teams of roboticists from all over the world converged on a Miami Speedway to compete. And while this may seem like an entirely altruistic enterprise, designing a robot for disaster response, it's not.
At the end of the day, people need to remember what the D in DARPA stands for. It stands for defense.
Peter Singer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century.
Too often, scientists try and kid themselves, act like, well, just because I'm working on this system that's not directly a weapon system, I have nothing to do with war. I remember speaking with a scientist who was funded by a Navy contract, and he was working on a robot that would play baseball. And he said, I don't have anything to do with war. I was like, come on. You know, you think the Navy's funding this because they, you know, want a better Naval Academy baseball team?
Or is it that tracking and intercepting a fly ball is analogous to tracking a missile? It's actually hard to find a roboticist who hasn't taken some kind of military funding. Ila Norbosch is one of the few. And while Norbosch acknowledges that good could come out of DARPA's push to build a search and rescue robot, he also sees an obvious dual use. If you set out to build a robot that can drive a regular car, climb a ladder, and operate a jackhammer,
that means that robot can manipulate an AK-47. That means that that robot can manipulate the controls of all the conventional military machines that we have as well.
Norbosch believes DARPA is pushing roboticists to build machines that can make complex decisions quickly and independently.
And it's a really interesting boundary to cross.
Imagine, he says, using
image recognition, where the drone is flying in the air, looking down, recognizing people's faces, matching them against a database of known faces on a kill list, and then deciding on its own, autonomously, whether it's going to shoot to kill or not.
Already, nations around the world are experimenting with loitering munitions. These are robots that hover over an area until they independently recognize the target they were assigned to destroy. But if a robot like that makes a mistake, who would be responsible? The programmer? The manufacturer? The military commander who launched it on its mission?
It forces us to confront whether we really control machines.
Ryan Kahlo is a law professor at the University of Washington. He says these kinds of tensions aren't just going to play out in the military, but are sure to crop up whenever we're tempted to allow robots to make complex decisions on their own. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Now it's time for the latest conversation from our Women in Tech series. All this month, we're speaking to innovators in tech, and we're talking about the best ways to encourage young women to consider engineering, computer science, and other tech fields as careers. Now, not many of us think of tech as glamorous, but fashion model and programmer, yes, you heard me right, Lindsay Scott is defying the stereotypes. When she's not busy modeling for Calvin Klein, Prada, and Louis Vuitton, Lindsay Scott creates apps, two of which were recently picked by Apple. And despite having walked the runway for Victoria's Secret, she is still proud to call herself a nerd. And Lindsay Scott is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So which came first, the beauty part or the geek part?
I was probably called a geek way before I was called a beauty. I definitely wasn't a model when I was in school, but I never called myself a geek back then. It was more of a painful term than a compliment. But now that people are using words like geek and nerd to describe me, as long as it means that I'm smart, I'm okay with it.
You're going to fly your geek flag high now, right?
Sure.
So when did you discover your love of computer science and all those kind of related areas? Is it something that you grew up with? Is it something that you kind of discovered just by kind of noodling around?
I first started playing around with computer programming when I was in middle school. I was given a TI-89 graphing calculator. I started looking through the documentation and realized I could make games on my calculator. So I didn't see it as computer programming at all at the time, just as a way for me to have fun games to play with.
We've spoken to a lot of women and girls in tech fields, and a lot of them say that they started kind of getting messages surprisingly early on that tech wasn't supposed to be for girls. I mean, that they weren't supposed to be in it. Did you ever feel that way?
No, not at all. Programming wasn't something that I was deterred from at all. In fact, my father was a computer programmer when it was in zeros and ones. Right now, nowadays, he types with one finger at a time on a computer, but he was involved with computer programming himself.
So at home, it was all good. It was kind of a consistent message. But at school, same thing?
I think it was fine. I was never the popular kid, so I don't know why that was the case, but I didn't necessarily realize that computer programming was uncool back then.
So when did the beauty part of your story emerge?
I didn't become a model until graduating from Amherst in 2006. And since then, I started growing more into myself and decided to give modeling a try.
Have you, you know, as an African-American woman, both sides of your identity are scarce in tech at the moment, mm-hmm. at the moment. And I just wondered if you have felt either aspect of your identity, either as an African-American or as a woman, is more relevant to the experiences that you have in tech?
In school, I didn't realize that there was such a gap, such a gender gap, such a racial gap in computer programming because my classes were fairly diverse. I know that nowadays only 2.4% of college graduates graduate with degrees in computer science, and only 12% of those are female. But my class was pretty even.
So why do you think those numbers are as they are? I mean, again, I'm not making you responsible for the rest of the industry.
Sure.
But why do you think that is? Do you have any thoughts?
I think people's stereotypes become a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. I think that women and people of color especially experience stereotype threat, where the threat that they can fulfill these negative stereotypes keeps people of color and women from participating in class discussions and pursuing careers in tech because they're afraid that they could, in fact, fulfill those negative stereotypes.
Did you ever feel that way?
At certain points, yes, definitely. Especially growing up, I was the only black person, actually, for the first 3 years of my preparatory academy in New Jersey. And having boys with these louder voices shouting over you and making you feel as if your answers weren't intelligent or as if you didn't completely fit in.
But going at it the other way, you know, it's interesting to hear about how your experiences as a beautiful woman may mm-hmm. interface with your experiences as a smart woman, because you have sometimes seen it where women who are either very pretty feel that they have to downplay their looks in order to be taken seriously, or you have other women who are perhaps less conventionally attractive sometimes feel that they're discriminated against because they're not pretty. So how do you work that? When you're working on your kind of computer science side, do you make a point of trying to tone it down, or do you just say, hey, this is me, I'm gonna let her rip, put on the 4-inch heels and do your thing, you know?
For the most part, over the years, my computer programming has been fairly solitary. So when I'm by myself, I'm not wearing the heels. I'm wearing the glasses, my broken glasses with the tape in the middle. But in my time as a model, especially, I've learned how to dress nicely and do my hair. And I like the way it makes me feel to be put together. So I do that because that's what I like to do. And when I'm interfacing with these technology people, as I've been doing over the past couple of months, I still make an effort to look okay because this is something that I enjoy doing. If anything, I just let my words speak for me. I let my knowledge speak for me. I'm not afraid to be perceived negatively because of my looks.
Let's talk about some of your projects in the couple of minutes that we have left. I understand that one of your latest
sure.
apps is called iPort for professional models, portfolios, and maybe actors could use it too, I guess, for headshots, right, or something?
Yes.
How does it work? And I also would love to know how you get your ideas.
I had the idea for this app because it was something I personally needed as a model to carry around these heavy books. I have 7 agencies worldwide, and to carry these around in my suitcase from one country to the next became difficult. So I created this app, not just for models, but also for other artists, for architects. I've heard people using this to show off their cakes, their cake baking. And for me personally, I love the fact that you can customize the table, you can customize the book. And I'm also working on implementing video so that you can page through the portfolio with both photos and video displays.
So before we let you go, what ideas do you have to encourage more women and girls to get into these fields?
Mm-hmm. I think for one, young people are very lucky to have the resources now that maybe they wouldn't have had before. Currently, only 1 out of 10 schools teaches computer programming. So luckily, code.org has created a great new initiative called Hour of Code, which will allow people for free, you can try out programming on your own. So even just that exposure to programming would allow more women to get involved with technology and try it out and participate in this ever-growing field. And I think girls in general should just put their fear aside when they go to their classes. It's important to participate. It's important to be heard and not let the stereotypes stop you.
Model and programmer Lindsay Scott joined us from our bureau in New York. And Lindsay Scott is tweeting a day in her life today as part of our Women in Tech series. You can follow along and jump in as you like at hashtag NPRWIT. Now, you know that hashtag has more than 7,000 tweets now. This community of women innovators and entrepreneurs is growing every day, and the conversation is interesting. Amanda Spann of IBM recently tweeted her day. She wrote, "I was afraid for the longest that because I didn't code, I couldn't work in tech. I reached out to friends in the industry. I sought out advice, feedback, insights, etc., until I ran into opportunity." In the next few days, we will hear from Stephanie Hill, a vice president at Lockheed Martin, Ingrid Vandervelt, co-founder of the Billionaire Girls Club. That's a group that mentors girls to foster entrepreneurship. And Regina Ajiri. She works in West Africa developing apps to help people with disabilities, and she's teaching girls there how to code. We hope you will follow these women and contribute your own stories and questions. You can find us on Twitter at hashtag NPRWIT.
The explosive pace of digital technology is changing police work. Over the past few weeks, we've reported on some new tools police are using, for example, Twitter scanners and license plate readers. Well, police will tell you that the most valuable tool is one they don't even own, your smartphone. Seized phones are now fundamental to every kind of investigation. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, police are finding those phones increasingly difficult to open.
Rolf Norton is a homicide detective in Seattle. If you ever run into him at a crime scene, he'll likely be watching to see if you own a smartphone.
I'm thinking there's probably a wealth of information that just got tucked into your pocket and something that we'd like to get our hands on.
It's got your calls, your emails, your calendar, your photos, your maps. That could be his whole case in one convenient package. That's also why more people now keep their phones locked, which means Norton sometimes has to turn on the charm.
You know, maybe you've established rapport and you're getting along with this person and they have a reason to want you to get in there too, you know, maybe trying to back up their story or whatnot. We'll reach out to that person and say, "Hey, your phone's locked. You know, we'd like to inspect it. We're probably going to be getting a warrant. You know, would you give us your password?"
But what if you refuse? Jeffrey Fisher is a law professor at Stanford, and he's arguing a smartphone case at the Supreme Court next month. He says the courts haven't really settled whether you have a right to withhold a password.
You're taking a risk that you can have anything from contempt of court to obstruction of justice, increased criminal punishment for failing to cooperate, and all kinds of other problems.
But forget about the legalities. There's a more practical consideration here. It may be the cops can get around your password.
So this software is pretty cool.
Nydia Cologne shows off a phone copying system at a company called Brickhouse Security in Manhattan. I let her plug it into an iPhone of mine, an old one.
So as you see here, it's acquiring all the data in your phone, from messages, contacts, call history, all the way down to your recovered data, even your tracking history.
This is just one of the phone copying systems that are on the market. The police sometimes call these digital forensics kits. The CEO at Brickhouse is Todd Morris. He says the smartphone makers definitely do not support this kind of software. It relies instead on a kind of global group effort.
It's a collaboration. There's no way that any one company can keep up with Apple or Google. You use programmers from all around the world, and they share what they find.
Forensic software relies on hacks. The most basic is the brute force attack. The software just throws passcodes at a phone until it opens. But that only really works on short four-digit codes. With longer passwords, you need another way in, some kind of a security hole. When hackers find one of these, they pass it around, and it eventually makes its way into the forensic kits. But that takes time. Dave Dunn is a security consultant who used to copy phones for the Seattle Police Department.
In some cases, you'll have a handset that comes in, say, January 1st of a year, and you can't get into it, and technology actually develops over the course of that year so that you can get into it 6 or 9 months later.
He says the phone's manufacturers keep making their systems harder to crack, even by them. Dunn says the cops sometimes ship iPhones to Apple and find there's a limit to what the company can recover.
They are only able to extract information from apps that are currently open.
That's because newer iPhones automatically encrypt information as it's saved. Security has become a selling point, especially on phones marketed to corporate customers. It also reflects the tech world's growing distrust of government, especially after the revelations about NSA spying.
You know, I think that at this point it's very difficult to trust any kind of policy-based solution.
This is Moxie Marlinspike. That's the pseudonym for a hacker who helped to create an encryption system for smartphones called Whisper. He's like a lot of tech people when he says he doesn't want to depend on the law to protect privacy.
There's something empowering about not asking for that type of protection. You know, that there's, I think, something empowering about just providing it for ourselves.
Still, technological fixes can backfire. Take the case of the iPhone 5S. It comes with a fingerprint reader. Cryptographically, that's a lot better than a four-digit PIN. But legally, maybe not. That's because you might be able to claim a constitutional right to withhold a password. But the Supreme Court has already said that the police don't need a warrant to get access to your finger. Martin Costi, NPR News.
On NPR.org, take a look at a more detailed list of some of the ways police can bypass the lock on Androids and iPhones.
Stick with us. There's lots more to come on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This week, the big players in the video game industry have gathered in San Francisco for the annual Game Developers Conference. The week-long event brings together not the people who buy video games, but the people who make them. The engineers, artists, writers, and companies big and small that they work for. Brian Crescente is there, covering it for Polygon, a video game news website. He joined us from San Francisco to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to ask you first about the big news out of the conference from Sony, which has announced something called Project Morpheus. It seems to me that's a very strange name. What is it?
Project Morpheus is a virtual reality headset. So this is a thing that would cover your face, sort of like a pair of ski goggles or maybe a scuba mask. And inside the headset is a high-definition screen. And this device, if it ever comes out, is designed to plug into a PlayStation 4 and allow people to play games using the console's motion-tracking Move controllers.
Motion-tracking what?
So the Move controllers are basically, they look a little bit like, I'd say, like ice cream cones. So you would hold these things in your hands. And if you have this headset on, you would look down and perhaps see, for instance, not just your hands, but you would see a sword in your hands. And, of course, your hands moving around as well. So it allows you to sort of move around in this virtual world. It is worth noting that this isn't the first or only virtual reality headset out there. Oculus VR is also showing off their latest headset, which is called the Rift. The key difference between these two is that the Rift is designed to plug into a computer, where the Project Morpheus is going to be working for a PlayStation 4.
This conference has long drawn international developers from places like Japan and Korea. What about China? Is there any kind of a presence from Chinese developers?
Yes, China is a growing force in game development and gaming, and one of the biggest internet companies in the world, Tencent, is actually here. And earlier this week, they said that they expect an influx of cheap phones in China to bring with it nearly another half billion or so mobile gamers to China alone. And their expectation is that those mobile gamers will, over time, sort of become people who play PC games and console games.
Well, now, there must be, I assume, some unusual, creative, quirky things that you're seeing out there. Give us an example of one of the stranger things you've noticed.
Well, I have to say, so this is not your typical tech convention. It's not like a bunch of loud booths. They have a lot of panels where people learn tricks of the trade, but they also hear about experimental games. One of my favorite talks this year was from Tracy Fullerton, who is the director of USC's Game Innovation Lab. What she talked about was how a team there is working on turning Henry David Thoreau's Walden into a video game. So the idea is that players will have to survive through 8 seasons of living on Walden Pond.
That is very strange.
It is. What's neat about it is that players can spend all their time sort of on the daily grind trying to complete their chores. That's not really fun, though. So if they tend to wander around in the woods, they'll discover these sort of small wonders, things like finding a mother partridge and her chick, or maybe seeing a perch leap from the pond. And the coolest thing is that the game is logging all of this. And then what it does is it uses that journal to write the player's own version of Walden, which I think is just fantastic.
Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Crescente is the news editor of Polygon. He joined us from San Francisco.